the truth about David Koch, the Super Bowl shuffle, a new Biden report, and more right now on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. Watch it.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
We're rolling. Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. This is Scott David Cosenza. Tim, I cleared that up for
that's
you.
That's a good... I appreciate that you did
to
the
go
David.
Serial killer with the full middle name so that you're not confused than anybody else.
Although it did give me a chance occasionally to ask a question for the sole purpose of being able to say Scott the Cosenza.
Yeah, which is okay, not
what
appropriate.
It is.
No,
right?
No.
I know. So, Scott David.
Well, I was going to thank you for joining me in studio today again. I guess I will continue to do so, even though you have to make fun of the name.
Okay. Thank you, Scott David.
We've got a lot to get through. Let's get into it.
Please.
I think for the first thing I want to cover is David Koch's death. Mm-hmm. And the reaction to it. I think that most people probably have no idea about the real David Koch. They know about the David Koch they've heard about the past few years that have been sort of demonized by the left. Harry Reid famously went on the floor of the Senate and called him like the worst Americans, the Koch brothers, that is. David and his brother Charles inherited their father's petrochemical company, which became then Koch Industries. They grew it from a nice, you know, basically they were kind of moderately rich. I think it had like $100 million in earnings when they inherited it in the 60s to the single largest privately owned company in the country. And if it were a Fortune 500 company, if it were publicly listed, it would be like a Fortune 50, I think, if not a Fortune 10 company. That's how big it was. And what they did with their money, they do with their money, is support freedom, free market, and free personal stuff. So they've been denigrated because they're against all these regulations like we have to use light rail instead of cars and that sort of thing.
Which is proven to be a boondoggle every time it's been tried. And I mean, even California had to shut it down just as their party was proposing it nationally.
Not
but
only
they
that,
couldn't
Tim,
even make it work in California.
You know what
California.
I was thinking about, too? We played that clip, if it wasn't last week, it was the week before, that Chinese social credit announcement that occurred on the train. That's another feature that you get with government control of everything is if you run afoul of somebody in the government, and one of the things that people on the left, you'd think you just want to grab them by the collar and shake them. You think that Trump is this crazy person. Don't you agree that we should have less government control of things so that way if a real crazy person is in charge that we're not suffering from?
No, people are in the moment now more than ever, Scott. They're not looking at 8 years. They'll say or do anything to bring down Trump. They don't care if it's used the other way in 8 years against them. They're not thinking about that. They don't care about that. And the people running for president or running for the Senate or Congress, a lot of them will be out of politics by then anyway. So what do they care? That's why they keep kicking the can down the road in terms of federal deficits and everything else.
Well,
let me say one thing about David Koch.
Go ahead.
My contribution to this discussion is simply to say that we should compare George Soros and David Koch, because those are the boogeymen for the left and right, respectively. And everybody says, well, David Koch is evil. Of course, he is projected as being evil.
Well, let me just stop
evil.
You. I want to interrupt you because I want to play, Tim, hold that thought in your head. I want to play the kind of thing that people are saying about David Koch.
All right.
And this is Bill Maher on David Koch.
Okay.
Some funeral news to report. Yesterday, David Koch of the zillionaire Koch brothers died. Please. Of prostate cancer. I guess I'm going to have to reevaluate my low opinion of prostate cancer. He was He was 79, but his family says they wish it could be longer, but at least he lived long enough to see the Amazon catch fire. Condolences poured in from all the politicians he owned.
I actually like that one.
Mourners are being asked in lieu of flowers to just leave their car engine running.
Do we have to listen to more of this?
Well, the closing part is important as well.
As for his remains, he has asked to be cremated and have his ashes blown into a child's lungs. Now, I know these seem like harsh words and harsh jokes, and I'm sure I will be condemned for them on
Fox News, which will portray
Mr. Koch as a principled libertarian who believed in the free market. He and his brother have done more than anybody to fund climate science deniers for decades, so fuck him. The Amazon is burning up. I'm glad he's dead, and I hope the Amazon comes.
Yeah. So that is so vile and contemptible that it's hardly even worth commenting on. We can usually make fun of a guy like Bill Maher, who occasionally, as we played last week, lurches uncontrollably into a reasonable position on something, such as the war on terrorism and Islam and Israel and everything. But for the most part, Bill Maher is a smug, contemptible, self-important. How this guy get so big anyway? I wonder, you know, for him to sit there on his show or stand there and proclaim without irony and with no sense of guilt or shame at all that he's glad this guy is dead. Let me tell you something. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to die one of these days. And now, if there's a cause for celebration to those of us on the right of center, libertarians, conservatives, whatever.
Well, pro-lifers mostly, I would say, okay, especially.
And pro-lifers.
Yeah.
Okay. But when she dies, I'm just talking personally. Of course, it's going to be tremendous benefit for the belief system that I possess, that the things I believe in.
And you will not celebrate her death.
I will not celebrate her death.
You know,
I won't
say. Because you're not an animal.
And I won't, you know, and I won't say, well, good riddance to her because she held back the cord.
Only a real Hitler type person can you celebrate the death of. But I want to say, you know, Bill Maher for years called himself a libertarian because he wanted to smoke. He wanted weed to be legal, basically.
Yeah,
okay,
that's good.
And
he
criticizes David Koch, who made his living in the petrochemical industry. Well, a couple things. Number one, David Koch was an actual libertarian. He didn't just want people to be able to buy and sell futures of light sweet crude, but also in 1980, when he ran Tim as a vice president on the vice presidential ticket for the Libertarian Party, he supported, for instance, the rights of gays. Now, you know, think about how to be on the vanguard of that kind of actual
liberalism. Open border. They're essentially open borders.
Oh, absolutely. They are. He's a libertarian. Now,
he's
brother,
for drug legalization, probably even beyond just marijuana.
And an anti-Trumper.
Right?
Oh, 100%.
And he
by
was
the way.
Not a pro-Trumper.
And it's not just, Tim, these are not just positions that he expressed, like, I wish we wouldn't have a drug war. No, they put their fortunes to work to make that a reality.
Okay, now let me finish the point that I was going to make about Soros
and
versus
Can I just
Koch.
Have one more thing to say about? Okay, no, go ahead. You
no,
do
no,
it.
No, no, no. Finish,
okay, all right.
Finish up. Finish
well, it
up,
was just
up.
That David and Charles Koch, David Koch made his home in Manhattan, in New York, with his family.
Right.
And Charles Koch makes his home in Wichita, Kansas, with his family. They don't have canned air that they breathe as they walk around this earth. They breathe the same air that you and I breathe, that every New Yorker breathes, that every Wichitan breathes. So the idea that he was comfortable with poisoning the environment is ridiculous, as they are of the environment. It makes no sense.
Because he was in the fossil, made millions and billions, whatever, in the fossil fuel industry, so he's therefore automatically evil to the point that, and I'm going to say I'm not sure it was Memorial in New York,
it was.
Rejected a $25 million
Can you imagine
grant,
the toxic, crazy thing?
$25 million contribution from David Koch because the people there wouldn't take millions of dollars. Now, I'm not 100% sure it was Sloan Kettering,
somebody.
Yeah, but the point is that it was somebody.
Yeah.
Now let me just say this about David Koch, because he needs to be compared head up to George Soros, because Both of them are wealthy beyond almost comprehension to the average person. Both of them made their money through capitalism. Koch in the energy industry, Soros in the finance industry, using currency manipulation, which is the ultimate capitalist tool. So they both made their money that
it's
way.
It's pure. You often pointed out it is pure capitalism. It's hilarious.
Pure, it's the most pure form of capitalism there is.
Yeah.
But that's where the similarity ends, because what David Koch does, or what he did, what Charles Koch has done, what the Koch family has done, is support the very kind of capitalist system that made them wealthy, and they want others to benefit as well. Soros,
yes,
on the other hand,
they want everyone to benefit from the free market that they did.
Soros, on the other hand, wants to turn around after making billions from the free market system, from the capitalist system, and the ultimate capitalist tool of currency manipulation, and now he wants to tear down the very system that made him wealthy. Yeah. That's the difference between David Koch and George Soros.
They want people to be free. That's,
freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom.
That's their bailiwick.
But they're conflated to some right wing. I mean, it's amazing that these positions on borders, on drugs, on gay marriage, and all these things get no publicity. That's why we have to keep talking about it here, because I imagine a lot of people listening right now don't know that he held those positions.
Yeah, I have to say, in terms of full disclosure and to talk about it, I worked for the Bill of Rights Institute. I was one of the I think I was the third hire over there at its infancy, and that was an organization. Well, it is still now. It's controlled by the Koch brothers. And I have spoken with Charles. I've never spoken with David, but their money doesn't come with restrictions to support fossil fuels or anything weird. Like, there's like some machinations of, no, it's just pro-liberty money. And they established the Bill of Rights Institute. Think about this. The Bill of Rights Institute. How many of the Bill of Rights do you think, like, you can draw a pretty direct line for a person of average intelligence to the petrochemical industry? It's a bit hard, right? It's more about an expression of individual rights. And they spent a fortune so that young Americans could be educated about their own rights. These include the rights to be free from search and seizure, the right to free speech.
It's why they say a guy like, David Koch was probably as wealthy as and had as much money as he could spend in a lifetime by the time he was, 25, 30 years old, whatever. So this idea that people like him, who've gotten incredibly wealthy, are promoting public policies just to enrich themselves doesn't actually make any kind of sense, does it?
No.
I mean,
and here's an interesting,
it's like Donald Trump.
About
Let
him,
me just,
by the way.
Just finish the thing about Trump, which is that, if he wanted to profit off of being in public office, he wouldn't have run for president.
Put a pin in that. We're going to talk
about that
in earnest in a minute. David Koch actually was in a plane crash. It was in a and it's funny. It wasn't you'd think it was a fancy private plane. It wasn't. It was like a pure little courier flight from the 80s at LAX. And he survived it. And many, many people on that plane did not survive. I think over 100 fatalities. In any case, he said he thought he was saved by God, so that he could use his work to fund these.
Ronald Reagan said the same thing after he was shot and came very much closer to death than people realized. That's what he said. He said, "God, if you save me, I will commit to doing the work that you put me on the earth to do."
So David Koch gave to libertarian organizations. He gave to, as you say, health. Plenty of places did take his money, thankfully.
Right.
And in fact, I think Sloan Kettering actually did take his money. I think it was probably somebody else, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we did an LNTV this week, and the joke of it was that David Koch is helping prolong Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life.
Yes, I know. I saw that.
Because
and it's
of that
good.
Donation.
It's great.
And also, if you go to the Metropolitan Opera House, I think most of that's been paid for by Koch money. So David Koch is
one of the best Americans, one of the best. What they want to say, though, is that he's just using this as cover to make himself seem legitimate while he's funding all these reactionary, extremist, right-wing organizations and causes. You can't win the fight. But I'm glad that you put it into the proper perspective with the facts.
His secret support for the right wing and his outward support for the rights of gay Americans in 19, I think it was actually 79 that quote's
from. That's amazing.
You know, show me a Democrat running today who expressed that kind of open support in the 70s.
And that is probably the most powerful demonstration of his commitment to absolute individual liberty.
Yeah. All right. Now we're going to turn to your chief job, Tim, which is, well, not just, we're going to get to the Biden correspondence in a second, but just the race, the correspondent for the race of president. And we have great news right now for the podcast, Tim. We have a new entrant in the race this week, and I've put together a little theme song for this new entrant into the race. Here we go.
Yeah, that Joe Walsh. I think it's great you did that too, because I'll tell you what, that Joe Walsh would stand a much better chance against Donald Trump than the Joe Walsh that's actually running.
When I first heard that quote unquote Joe Walsh was running, I literally thought, from the Eagles, Joe Walsh? Like,
yeah, right.
Who is the political Joe Walsh? Who are we talking about?
He could garner a few votes.
Yeah.
More than this guy's going to garner. This guy's, he's a former congressman. He hosts a talk show, and he calls himself a radical advocate for free speech, so that he deliberately says things to inflame people. And it's gotten him into a lot of trouble. But the problem is that he's running against Trump because he says Trump is the problem, not his policies, but he doesn't have the moral fitness to be president. Okay? He doesn't have the moral, he said he's morally unfit to be president. That's why I'm running. We got to have, because he's ruining the Republican Party. That's what the whole Never Trump wing is saying. The problem with that is that Mr. Walsh himself is actually an active promoter of conspiracy theories about Barack Obama's birthplace. Sound familiar? Repeatedly referring to Obama as a Muslim. Okay. Elevating a white nationalist, giving him a lot of airtime, and some are saying fawning coverage on his radio show. And this is the best one, Scott. This is the best one. He took to Twitter at one point to defend his right to say blacks are lazy. I'm serious. This is all fact.
This guy's a Republican?
He's a Republican.
And they think that's gonna help things?
Nobody thinks it's going to help things except Joe Walsh himself.
Yeah, well,
and
you know,
not
he's probably
going
to get a bunch more listeners for his show. So that is that's something to think about.
Sure. I mean, why do you think maybe this is a natural segue out of order into Kirsten Gillibrand, because Joe Walsh has as much chance of beating Trump as Kirsten Gillibrand had of securing the Democratic nomination for president of the United States. Shall we go out of order and just, because now we're talking about losers here. I mean, Kirsten Gillibrand is at the head of the list.
I'm calling up the tweet now, which I think.
What, Senator Gillibrand's tweet?
No. This is the Trump tweet. A sad day for the Democrats. Kirsten Gillibrand has dropped out of the presidential primary. I'm glad they never found out that she was the one I was really afraid of.
Did he actually tweet that? Oh, that's too good.
His trolling is epic.
Oh, that's too good.
Absolutely epic.
Oh, that.
Yes.
I stand in awe and admiration. That is so funny.
He's one of the best trolls in the business, for sure.
That's amazing. Thank you for bringing that up. So anyway, they approached him, and he said, well, I'm a radical. And yes, I've made racist tweets in the past. You know, he said, but I did it for the guy said to him, you say that, you know, Trump is unfit for office, and yet you tweeted that blacks are lazy. And he said, yes, I did tweet that, and it's a racist tweet, but I didn't tweet it because I meant it. That was his explanation.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. So that's about all the time Joe Walsh is worth.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, one more thing on Gillibrand, because let's have some fun with it.
All right.
Okay, Kirsten Gillibrand is by Tucker Carlson. He beat me to it. Gosh darn it. He went on his show on Wednesday night and said she's the worst presidential candidate ever.
Okay.
Now, that's a pretty tall order given the field just this year by itself.
The rent is too damn high party guy.
I love that guy. Oh, he's a great candidate. You kidding me?
The rent is too
high. But I would like to ask you a searingly serious question. You like that alliteration there, searingly serious?
Put my thinking hat on.
Okay. So put your thinking cap on. Here's a question for you. All time, is the worst presidential candidate of all time really Kirsten Gillibrand, or was it Eric Swalwell? Okay, because that's a really hard question to answer. Which one was the most pathetic?
I think that it was Gillibrand. And the reason why, Tim, is that I think she had some name recognition before. So Swalwell had none. So at least he's actually improved his brand in the sense that, you know, you can say,
well, you know who he is.
You can say 90% of those people may think he's an idiot, but 10% probably don't. And so,
and 100% know who he is.
Right, exactly.
Okay, sure, I'll buy that.
And so for it's a bigger plus for him than for
Gillibrand. That's true, because Gillibrand got zero traction. She started at 1% and went backwards.
She showed herself to be a failure.
She is the most pathetic, pandering, phony. And you know what? Again, I actually enjoy this. It's the last thing I'll say because it's all the time she deserves. But I actually like saying this because it's the one time I actually defend the Clintons. And that is that Kirsten Gillibrand would never have been senator if Hillary Clinton hadn't backed her when Hillary left to be Secretary of State. And she was all behind the Clinton. She was down with a cause. She was involved in the 2016 Clinton campaign. And then Clinton lost. And then the Me Too movement started. And Kirsten Gillibrand immediately threw the Clintons under the bus because they couldn't do anything for her anymore. Yeah. And so she said that Bill Clinton probably should have been removed from office in the 1990s. Wow, that is political courage to kick people at the lowest point of their career. I don't care who it is. That, to me, says everything you need to know about Kirsten Gillibrand, the ultimate opportunist.
Okay.
How do I really feel?
Yeah.
People like that make me sick.
I actually think that the worst thing you could say about Kirsten Gillibrand is her continued intractable support for Emma Sulkowitz, who is Mattress Girl, who falsely alleged rape against a man called Paul Nungesser at NYU, or was it Columbia now? No, it was Columbia, right? I don't know, the memories.
I can't save you there, bud.
But in any case, so she lionized this woman, brought her to Congress to sit in the gallery with her mattress to basically put forth this false notion that she was sexually assaulted, and she wasn't. She's part of this whole Me Too thing in the not the kind of healthy degree of, well, men need to behave acceptably, but the if any woman ever says anything about somebody who identifies as male, then that person is guilty and cannot be proven innocent because the mere allegation by the person identifying as female is the gold standard of truth.
Let me put a coda on that about Gillibrand. I'm going to do something almost as hard, maybe even harder than defending the Clintons, which is to defend former Senator Al Franken, who was a subject of a political hit job from Kirsten Gillibrand, who ran him out of the Senate because she was planning to run for president and wanted to be a warrior in the Me Too movement. Franken never deserved to win the office to begin with. So there's some sort of divine justice here.
That was Norm Stamper's seat.
He cheated.
Yeah. Or the party apparatus on his behalf. Cheated.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Right. The end result was that he benefited from a crooked election, though it was very, very close. Nevertheless, in this situation, what he had done, something that he did on camera, which was actually fairly done in a joking way years before, and he gets run out of the Senate on that, and that's because of Kirsten Gillibrand, who is a craven opportunist to beat the band.
Yeah. Okay. Not fans on at this.
Not fans of Gillibrand.
Yeah, right, right. No. We won't be disappointed that we donated to
the worst of
candidacy.
A worst of a horrible field. I would rather support Marianne Williamson, just on record.
Yeah. By the way, I think that my initial judgment of her was a little bit off. She is a bit of a wingnut, but not mostly a wingnut.
You're not scared of those dark psychic forces unleashed by the president of the United States?
She's growing on me in a good way. All right.
Uh-oh,
well, let's go to your...
Scott has the hots for Marianne Williamson. I can't believe
it. Let's turn to your core competency, Tim, and as careful listeners of The Uprising.
And that was not my core competency?
No,
are you implying that... Never mind.
It's the first son of the first state, Joe Biden, and his quest.
I got to hand it to you. You come up with these ones like Wilmington White House. I like that one. You always have some new,
yes, sir.
Really
yes.
clever.
You know why? That's because I'm not from... No, I was going to say... That was going to be a Delaware joke. Forgive me, folks from Delaware. I'm willing to have anti-Delaware bias on the Uprising pot. It's a place for people of all 50 states to feel comfortable.
Because you have to drive through and pay tolls, and you hate it.
You're
Let's
right.
just put
it's
it
true.
In context.
And I fear the troopers there. So, well, it's been a light last week or so on the coverage of Biden. I know that we've got a bumper crop today of Biden things to sort out and go through. So I'll turn it over to you, Tim. Where do things stand with Joe Biden's quest to become our next ruler?
Well, as Yogi Berra once famously said, it gets late early around here. And while it seems that, you know, we're 15 months out or 14 and a half from the election to think it's still early, I think we're reaching the stage where it's no longer just early. We're moving into the September debate, which will basically pare the field in half. We've already got dropouts from Gillibrand and who is the guy,
Exactly.
The Jay Inslee.
Doesn't even
Jay
matter.
Inslee.
Yeah, right.
Jay Inslee.
So who's the guy? Who's the other guy
Jay
who's never going to win anything?
Governor of the state of Washington and a true radical in his own right. I think a genuine radical, unlike Gillibrand. So, but anyway, you've dropped. They're starting to drop like flies.
Yeah.
Only half the field is qualified. But Biden, you know, he's basically stubbornly holding to about 30%. It's dropped a little bit to 28, 27, and that's at the expense of, or his loss comes, his loss is basically Pocahontas's gain. She has set herself apart from the rest of the progressive field, because if you look at the numbers over a sweep of, say, a couple of months, 3 months, everyone else has been pretty much stable. Bernie's been between 14 and 18. Mm-hmm. Harris was at about 5 or 6. She went up to maybe 10. She's back down to 8. Nobody else has steadily risen in the polls except Elizabeth Warren. And she's now clearly in second place. And in both New Hampshire, which is strange she has any kind of problem there because, of course, it neighbors Massachusetts. Yeah. But she's standing third up there now. And she's
maybe even their Democrats have that a little bit of an individual streak. Given
they do. New Hampshire loves to build themselves up as you need to come to our town hall meetings, because if I can't shake my hand and have a cup of coffee with you, I'm not going to vote for you. Don't get me started. But in any case, so Pocahontas is rising. Biden is falling a little bit, but Pocahontas is taking some from Biden as she gets more institutional support. People are starting in the institutional Democratic Party, I think, are starting to be able to sort of envision the possibility of her actually being the nominee. I don't think they've gotten that far with anybody else except Biden. So the race is, as we go into September, this is where they separate the ladies from the girls. And Biden... I don't know that I've ever seen this happen before, but he's recognizing, as he should, or his advisors are recognizing, that the only reason that he's at the top of the polls is because people think, I think the name recognition is part of it still, not fully, is that people think that he may be the only one that could actually beat Trump because these other people are way too far to the left. So they're throwing the idea that Biden actually stands for anything right out the window. it's pretty much he can win, he can win, yes, he can win. And
it's about one team versus the other team, and who cares if you win dirty or not? If you get the ring, you win the Super Bowl, you win the Super Bowl.
Now, there's a two-pronged thing here. The first one is his wife, Dr. Jill
Thank
Biden.
Thank you for that.
Going on TV, she was on, I think this was Today's Show, and she gave an apologia for why people should vote for her husband, even if they don't really like him that much.
You may like another candidate better, but you have to look at who is going to win. You know, your candidate might be better on, I don't know, health care than Joe is. But you've got to look at who's going to win this election. And maybe you have to swallow a little bit and say, okay, I sort of personally like so-and-so better. But your bottom line has to be that we have to beat Trump.
Right. So what she's saying is, look, pay no attention to his gaffes. Pay no attention to his hands all over women. Yeah. Pay no attention to you know, put you all back in chains. Pay no attention to his gaffe, the gaffe machine that is his campaign, and just vote for him because, you know, what she's saying is, come on, guys, he's the only one that has a chance against Trump. So what do you really care what
and
he
that's
believes?
The exact.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I'm sure that the Democrats, sadly, are not going to take my advice, but it is solid advice. That's a cancer for the eventual candidacy. The best candidate, fight like a dog. That's what the primaries are for. You know, as a person who has an interest in politics in the United States, Tim, the primary is the most interesting time. That's when actual ideas are thought about.
It's the way it should be. So what happens now, Scott, if he starts dropping in the polls? Now the one basis for his candidacy is pulled right out from under him. So
what's the good doctor's prescription for that?
Well, I want to play you the kind of things they're going to have to cover over that Biden's been doing consistently. But I'm not going to bore the listeners and viewers with the whole string. Just play this one, Biden and poor kids, and you'll get the idea.
We have this notion that somehow if you're poor, you cannot do it. Poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids.
Okay, so there
they
you
are.
Go. I mean, he actually said that because we have the actual audio. He actually said that. But now to go back to the original subject.
Well, hold on. Just stop there for a second.
Okay.
And it's a funny line. I like it. And we also know that Joe Biden has no – it's not a racist thing.
No, of course
And
not.
The thing is, it would be fun if we could just laugh at it and that they could do the same if it was on the Republican side. That's the kind of world I want to live in. We joke about that. And then somebody who – you know, but we have this unhinged reality where if Trump were to say that, it would be – all of a sudden, this crazy dog whistle, right, that we're talking about.
I just put it this way. If Donald Trump were to walk on water, the headline would be, Trump can't swim.
Yeah.
Okay, now let me go back and finish off the part about how they're playing up the polls.
Okay.
Because Joe Biden said that. That was a very deliberate thing. He sends out his wife to give a message for him. And then they release the commercial, playing into his electability and nothing else.
We know in our bones this election is different. The stakes are higher, the threat more serious. We have to beat Donald Trump.
Hold on, I'm going to start it again. I love the guy, though.
It's I know, like, he's great.
You know,
isn't
he's
he?
A great, he's I, like an Ohio, Wisconsin white guy. That's who this pitch
I have
is for. Right?
I have voice envy.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
God,
right,
this guy's voice.
All right, let's leave it to him.
Start it again.
We know in our bones this election is different. The stakes are higher, the threat more serious. We have to beat Donald Trump. And all the polls agree Joe Biden is the strongest Democrat to do the job.
Okay, so that's that. There.
All the polls agree, Tim.
That's all
what
the
else?
Polls.
What else do you have to ask? You going to vote or not?
All the polls agree.
Yeah.
So he's basically saying, all right. So, you know, I'm a couple watts shy of a full light bulb, but you know what?
Who are you going to vote for?
It's actually
a loser.
It's like a three-prong election in a sense, Scott, because you've got Trump. Trump is Trump. Trump is Trumpism. Make America first. Secure the border. Put up the wall. The whole thing. The second part is the radicals in the Democratic Party who want to overturn the economy and start all over with the Green New Deal and with Medicare for All and all that. And then the third entry in this election is Biden. And look, I'm not going to do anything radical. I'm just going to return things to the way they were before this crazy guy was elected. Okay, so he's just a return to normalcy. And that's really a third choice that voters have in this election. They have Trump, they have radical socialism, and they have going back to the way it was under Obama and Biden.
There may be one additional component of that Biden ad, which is, and I've never kind of embraced this or quite gotten it, but people want to back a winner. I remember when I was a kid, Tim, I think it was 1985 that the Chicago Bears won the Super Bowl. I had never seen a Chicago Bears jersey or jacket or hat in my neighborhood before, okay? It's an Eagles town. All of a sudden, you know, the McKeevers across the street are coming in with their Bears memorabilia on. You think, what's that about?
Well, the 85 Bears were arguably one of the greatest, one of the five greatest teams in NFL.
But the point is, people want to support a winner.
Yeah.
So if you can build the identity and the momentum of a winner, then presumably those people who are interested in that, you know, psychologically, that they want to be on the winning team, you know, maybe you get some more support that way. But we'll just have to see. All right, is there any more Biden news this week?
No more Biden news. I got one more clip before I bow out and let you take it solo.
We're going to build up to that just in just a second.
You see, I'm already speechless at the thought of playing this
guy. So I've got some Rachel Maddow. Yeah, well, before we get to your clip, I want to talk about this. I have a Rachel Maddow TDS. I always get
Trump
the initials
derangement
wrong.
Yes, syndrome, yes.
Clip as well and a response from the Donald. This is about the emoluments clause. Do you want to – you always throw it to me, Tim, at these on our various products, whether it's a – Liberty Nation TV segment or Liberty Nation Radio for the legal ruling. Why don't you go ahead and let everybody know what is the emoluments clause? What does it say? What does it actually prevent?
Well, I was going to ask you. I mean, you're Mr. Legal Eagle, but the emoluments clause. Let's bring it down to its basics. That a public official, in this case, the president of the United States, cannot profit from his position in office, which means that he has to give up his businesses and et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, let me put the subhead on this, which is that Donald Trump has lost tens or hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay, well, stop. We're gonna let Donald talk to us about that. Okay,
right. But the point is that,
and you're low on the estimate.
I'm sure I am.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to be conservative so nobody can say that I'm exaggerating. But the point is that if the guy wanted to profit from being profit.
Well, that's the derangement syndrome.
He would never run for president.
So the operative clause of the emoluments provision in Article 1, Section 10 is that the president can't accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Right.
And the emolument is basically like this thing of great value.
Right.
And Rachel Maddow acts like this is some kind of federal law that is, you know, codified that, you know, is regularly prosecuted or whatever.
Of course she does.
And then the news broke that Attorney General Bill Barr is hosting a holiday party, privately paid for holiday party at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. And then let's... The sort of, you know, we used to do more, I think, Tim, a little bit of the dispelling fake news on the uprising. We haven't done it in a few weeks anyway, like really getting. I think this is like a fake news thing where this is put forth as some kind of news. And I'm going to make the case that it is the exact opposite
Scott,
of anything.
Scott, anything said by anybody pretty much on MSNBC or CNN is by definition fake news. So when we're playing a soundbite of anybody from one of those places,
we're deconstructing the fake news.
Is the fact that such a thing would be wildly and flagrantly illegal. There is literally an explicit line in the U.S. Constitution that says the president can't take stuff from foreign countries. He can't enrich himself from foreign governments while he's in office. So, as I say, 24 hours ago, right? This time last night, this whole thing with the president saying, oh, we should host the next G7 in my club, Doral, it's perfect. This time last night, that seemed insane, yes, but also totally impossible, right? I mean, yes, clearly the president wants to hold the G7 at his private club so he and his family can profit from it personally.
There you go.
Yep.
There you go.
That is so blatantly illegal. It's literally against the black letter.
By the way,
is this all
so,
they've got, Scott?
So blatantly, I mean, illegal. Like it's one of the most highly illegal things a person could do.
Any man walking on the street knows how.
This is a long one, but it's illegal. Worth it. All right, back to Rachel.
Yeah.
Law of the Constitution. We do still have law enforcement in this country. So as insane as it was that the president is trying to promote that as an idea, at least we can be sure that that won't happen, right? Right? Well, then tonight, we got this on the front page of the Washington Post.
Oh.
Attorney General William Barr, top law.
A bombshell.
Oh,
official in the United States, books Trump's hotel for a $30,000 holiday party.
Here we go. Oh, boy.
So don't worry. It is clearly illegal for the president to set himself up to personally profit from his presidency by making it so that people who want to or need to do political business with him can pay him in order to do that. Don't worry, America. That's illegal. Law enforcement won't let that happen.
Right. Like it's a criminal matter. Law enforcement won't let that happen. Like if we had a real attorney general, he would go put the cuffs on a president who did that.
Enforcement in this country will get right after the attorney general, the top law enforcement official in the country, pays the president and his family more than $30,000. Because this year, after Trump named William Barr to be attorney general, this year William Barr decided he would move his annual holiday bash to the president's hotel. So this time he can pay the president and his family.
So Rachel Maddow, Tim, thinks that if I follow you tell me, okay, because it's Rachel Maddow, it's MSNBC. You tell me if I'm picking up the bread trail here. Trump is thinking about who would be a good attorney general for him. Somebody puts a bug in his ear. Hey, this guy every year pays deep into five figures for a holiday party. I know you have
obviously
this hotel
that's
over there.
What happened,
I can get you a booking, a solid annual. By the way, if you're in office for 8 years, that's eight bookings of a holiday party. If he can switch the venue,
That's a perfectly legitimate reason to name someone as attorney general. You
know, and I mean, by the way, here's
the problem
other thing.
With that is what?
Here's the other thing. Let's say, by the way, let's say it's 50,000 in the party, okay? Because it could be that high with the open bar. People go top shelf, and why wouldn't you? Okay, let's call it 50 grand. How much of the 50,000, after the waiters and the taxes and the booze is paid for, actually gets to a Trump, because let's be clear here, that I want to really do the math on this, Tim. It's not a $50,000 bribe that she said brought William Barr into office, because clearly if it's a $50,000 bill for the hotel, only some small fraction of that actually gets to the Trumps. What could it be? Could it be 10 thousands of those dollars?
All right, you made the point.
Okay,
I mean,
it's a $10,000 bribe.
It's so ridiculous. Look, Scott, it's very simple to understand why they're doing this. Beyond just that they can't stomach Donald Trump for even a moment and believe him to be evil, believe him to be a unique threat that is increasingly, you're hearing this word on the left, it's an emergency. It's an emergency.
Yes.
Therefore, emergency preparations are extraordinary.
You know why?
You'll do things.
All the other rules have to go out the window. If the house is burning, we don't have to, we just go.
That's exactly right. But here's the thing. They know perfectly well that they cannot beat him on the issues. They cannot beat him on the economy. They can't beat him on foreign policy because they don't have one. They can't beat him on employment and jobs. They can't beat him on all the leading indicators, with the possible exception of health care, but they've kicked that away because now it's Medicare for all, unless it's Joe Biden. So they've kicked away the one big advantage that they did have. They cannot beat him on the issues, so they must go after him personally. And,
idea one second. Here's a data point for you, Tim, that came out after the Post published its story. He booked the Willard, and they double booked the room. So there's a hotel, big hotel in Washington, D.C. called the Willard Hotel.
Right.
And he had booked his party at the Willard, and unbeknownst to him, they double booked, and then they called and canceled on him. So then you know what he did? He tried to go somewhere else. He tried to go to the Mayflower, I think, in another hotel, and he couldn't get in. And then only after that Did he book it at the Trump Hotel?
Oh, come on. They had to have made that up.
It's hilarious.
It's all a canard. Now, this is, by the way, you mentioned the Willard Hotel. Yeah. Just so people know, there's an interesting fun fact about the Willard Hotel, a great old historic hotel in D.C. That's where the term lobbying
because of the lobby of the Willard
born.
Hotel.
The lobby of the Willard Hotel there was where people with an agenda.
Even more damnable indictment of General Barr on that front,
that's
Tim.
That's true. You're right. It's even worse. But that's where people with an agenda would go sit in the lobby and wait for President Ulysses S. Grant to appear
and lobby him.
Correct.
Here's what the president himself had to say about getting rich off these things and the emoluments.
Good.
Here we go.
I actually have a question for you on next year's G7 summit, but can I just clarify something you said? You mentioned earlier today.
One question. Go ahead.
Let me do the clarification and then I'll get to the question.
No.
You talked about
one
calls
question.
With.
I just left that part in, by the way. You see the disrespect, right? I say one question. So, by the way, if you want to ask.
No, Mr. President. I'm going to ask as many as I want, and there's nothing you can do about it. Yeah, that's their attitude.
Breaking news alert. I'm trying to understand what specifically you heard from China. And on next year's G7, you alluded today, dropped several hints about Miami, about Doral, and hosting next year's G7 at your property. What reassurances, if any, can you give the American people that you are not looking to profit off the presidency?
Well, I'll tell you what. I've spent, and I think I will, in a combination of loss and opportunity, probably it'll cost me anywhere from $3 to $5 billion to be president. And
$3 to $5 billion
I care about is this country. Couldn't care less, otherwise I wouldn't have done it. People have asked me, what do you think it costs? And between opportunity, not doing things, I used to get a lot of money to make speeches. Now I give speeches all the time. You know what I get? Zippo.
I thought that was the funniest line.
Only he could say that, and you've got to be sitting there going, yeah, you know, he's got a point. I mean, but I think, you know, most people probably think he's profiting even more from being president. It's another thing that the person, you know, on the street does. Now, the media is, there's a couple of things you got to understand about the media. Why they hate Trump so much beyond just that he's Trump and he stands for things they hate and he's racist and all this stuff that offends their virtue signaling. It's that, number one, he cut them right out with his Twitter wars in 2016. He cut out the middleman and they couldn't stand it. Fast forward to when he's president and now he's given up having those press conferences, or his press secretary having his press conferences, and so you don't get these reporters on camera anymore. You don't get Jim Acosta asking the question, which can then be shown not only on CNN, but other networks as well. So they don't get the FaceTime. So when they finally do, they're desperate.
Because
most of the time, when you see the president now, he's answering questions like over by the helicopter.
Yes.
And so you're just
so
seeing him.
They don't get to be the stars. That's brilliant if that was a considered move on his part.
I'm sure.
Wow.
I'm sure it
that's
was.
Really great.
So you only see him in the frame.
So he takes their celebrity out of it. They don't get to be a part of it.
And most of the time, you don't even hear what the question was. You only hear his response, and that's on most of the networks.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, it's interesting. I cut it out for brevity's sake, but at the top of the Bill Maher clip that I played where he celebrated the death of philanthropist David Koch, he made fun of Trump's long press conference before he got on the helicopter, which is funny because so if he didn't give any press conferences, they would be railing on him about he was cloistered and didn't care what the American people think, but that he's willing to stand there for an hour and ask any question that's asked. Then he's denigrated for it as well.
Trump secures world peace, poverty workers lose jobs.
Right.
There you go.
All right, so you had a clip to demonstrate the Trump derangement syndrome.
This is my bow out because I got to give it to the left on one thing. They come up with the most inventive ways of saying how deplorable, how despicable, how irredeemable, how Hitler-like Donald Trump really is. And this guy, CNN and MSNBC had dueling psychiatrists on this week.
To talk about how crazy Donald Trump is. To violate their oaths, their Hippocratic oaths.
Sure.
And
they're making a diagnosis on someone they've never met.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is It's
professionally incompetent.
Medicine 101.
Yeah.
You never diagnose. You can give him general principles, but he's making a specific diagnosis. So the guy on MSNBC was pretty bad. He was a Harvard psychiatrist.
They should remove his license to practice. That's really what
I really think so, because
this guy's actually dangerous. It's part of, Mattis had a book that's out now, Mad Dog James Mattis.
Yes.
And he talks about how it's like we're at a tipping point with our dagger's draw with each other. And, that kind of, in addition to being medically inappropriate and wrong, to actually act like seriously, like you can say that this person is because what's appropriate then is, like you say, we talked about before, is the emergency. If there really is somebody who's undergoing significant mental illness, well, then he has to be removed. And toot sweet.
Now, here's the approach of the psychiatrist that went on CNN. Lately, the left has gone from Russian collusion, which they know there's nothing there, that's a dry hole. You're not hearing anything about impeachment. They know that's not going to happen. So now what they're focusing on, they're going back to the idea that Trump is truly deranged, that he really is not in control of his faculties, and that in fact, he might even be, or in the case of many leftists, they're sure he is mentally ill. But this psychiatrist went on CNN, a guy who's worked with a lot of mentally ill, and made the following statement in defense of the mentally ill.
It stigmatizes the mentally ill. I've known thousands of patients. Almost all of them have been well-behaved, well-mannered, good people. Trump is none of these. Lumping the mentally ill with Trump is a terrible insult to the mentally ill.
Okay. I rest my case, counselor. He actually said that on national television.
Well, let me speak in his defense and maybe try to get you to agree with me.
Now, I've been a longtime advocate for the mentally ill. I sat on a board of a major, so I'm not I'm not like these crazy people.
I think there's actually an important point, which is to say that if somebody behaves in a way that you don't like and disfavor in the extreme, it's not appropriate to just say that they are mentally ill, because that does demonize the mentally ill in a way that's not appropriate. Mental illness doesn't have anything necessarily to do with any of the negative aspects of Donald Trump that these people don't like, the things that he says or tweets
but
or whatever.
But to use the mentally ill as a cudgel against Donald Trump to say it's an insult to the mentally ill to compare them to Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know how much further you can go than to say maybe the worst thing that would be to say, well, Hitler was bad, but Trump, well, that's a whole new level.
All right, well, we're going to let you go. We're going to talk about dog whistles a little bit later on.
You can't have a dog discussion without me as part of it. I guess that'd be in on
it. This is a different kind of a dog whistle.
Okay, sure.
And we're going to go over the back page abomination in earnest on the next segment of The Uprising. Tim, thanks so much for joining us for this week, and we'll see you next one.
You know what I always say, always a guilty pleasure.
Okay, we're going to finish the rest of the podcast here at the Upper Uprising Studios, and I want to go over two things. The amazing news out of the back page prosecution in Arizona, for the defendants anyway, and another black mark against the Justice Department and charging authorities. And also, I want to play for you somebody who is not a pro-Donald Trump person, but who has a strong message against the sort of craziness that we're seeing out there in terms of the anti-Trumpism that has gone unhinged. So Backpage website was an adult classifieds advertising various forms of sex for sale, escorts and so forth. And that wasn't enough, though, to get it sort of put on a hit list that mattered to it. In other words, they could conceivably argue basically that those ads weren't necessarily for sex for sale. And so they were able to continue making a living by selling these ads. That started to change during a concerted effort against them by various law enforcement authorities. I think a sheriff in Illinois, went after the credit card processors for Backpage ads. That was one of the sort of first shots across the bow that kind of turned against them in terms of legally. And then they were called in front of the Senate and basically said that they were having knowing facilitation of child sex trafficking. You see, it wasn't enough to just be trafficking or basically benefiting off of prostitution ads in order to bring the might of the federal government and so much calories sort of to burn against it. Because by and large, while people may say they don't wish prostitution to be legal, and perhaps that's a majority opinion, what they generally don't want is a lot of calories burned on it. You don't want to have to pay for the additional police resources, prosecution, and jailing basically enforce what is a victimless crime, if it is in fact a victimless crime, which is to say that they are adults who are behaving consensually with their commercial sexual activities. Well, that's how the powers that be got to get Mr. Lacey and Larkin, who were the owners of Backpage, arrested. They're scheduled for trial, in the spring of next year, on these federal charges that basically they were in league with not necessarily directly in league, but they're benefiting off of child sex trafficking, and that's what makes them some of the most evil people in the world. As you might imagine, they would be if it were true. The thing is, with charges like this, part of the reaction to them is to sort of make the people who are charged thusly sort of radioactive. And people don't want to come to their defense or even look into sort of how many layers deep these charges actually go, because the idea is that, well, what's wrong with you? You're defending these animals. Well, the thing is, you have to get in there, because what happens is the charge itself can be enough of a punishment that there is no hope for these people if they don't get a robust defense. Well, guess what? Fortunately for them, they've got a ton of dough because the sex trade was good to them in terms of money, and they're able to mount a defense. And something great happened in that defense. I think it was last year when a mistake happened. The assistant U.S. attorney involved in the case mailed a copy of some memos to the defense unwittingly. And those memos were internal Justice Department memos from 2012 and 2013. And they pose a big problem for the prosecution. We know all this, by the way, because of a great piece in Reason Magazine by Elizabeth Nolan Brown called Secret Memos Show the Government Has Been Lying About Backpage All Along, aptly worded. And she writes, in 2012, the federal prosecutor seemed impressed by how cooperative Backpage was with police and other members of law enforcement, because they offered a goldmine of information for investigators. They gave them their data stream. They said that staff would respond to subpoenas within the same day with respect to any child exploitation investigation. They often provided records within the hour, and they regularly provided live testimony at trial to authenticate the evidence against defendants who utilized Backpage. And they held seminars for law enforcement on how best to work with Backpage staff and records. Witnesses have consistently testified that Backpage was making substantial efforts to prevent criminal conduct on the site and was coordinating efforts with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They were doing the exact opposite of what was alleged. It's not even that the federal prosecutors demonized these people, and then we find out that, well, maybe they didn't deserve to be quite so demonized. It's the exact opposite of the truth. They're in the dock because the government says they are in league with the worst of human beings, people who would send children into sexual slavery, or at least teenagers into sexual slavery. But it turns out what they're doing is actually helping the fight against that teenage sexual slavery. It's the exact opposite. And so these prosecution efforts, and it's this one-step thinking, well, there are occasionally ads for teenage prostitutes on Backpage. Well, let's shut down Backpage. Well, now where are those girls? Well, it's harder to find them. It's harder to find them and rescue them or get them into safety or prosecute their pimps or whatever. Backpage was a resource. It actually helped the fight against this thing that they're being charged with. And it's an abomination that they're using the taxpayer dollars to hold a gun to their head to try to put them in a cage for the rest of their life and then send us the bill. Meanwhile, they're frustrating the efforts of people who are actually trying to save young women who are in fact pimped or subjugated to this kind of life. It's these federal prosecutors, boy, they need to be held to some kind of standard where when they do these sorts of things, they actually suffer some negative fate beyond just getting a job at a well-paid job at a law firm after their tenure. There seems to be no discipline in this area. And boy, is it frustrating for somebody who thinks that they should actually be out there going for the whole truth and trying to promote liberty rather than, of course, the political notion. I'm sure that one of them was running for what? For governor? For attorney general of the state they lived in? Who knows? But that's the smart money bet. Okay, well, in better news, or not necessarily news, but the Contra Krugman podcast is perhaps one of the most fun podcasts out there. It's Tom Woods and Bob Murphy, who are economists, and they do a job of taking down Paul Krugman's columns, and a great job at it they do, and some other things as well. But I heard this on the podcast and just thought I would share it with you because I thought it was quite perfect. This is from a post by a man called Scott Alexander on Slate Star Codex, which I guess is his website. And I will quote from the Alexander piece, and then I'll play Mr. Woods' commentary about it. But I think you'll really enjoy it. He says, this is about the idea that, you know, Donald Trump is this dog whistle thing where he says something and it's a secret message for the racists. Okay. Dog whistling seems to be the theory that if you want to know what someone really believes, you have to throw away decades of consistent statements supporting the side of an issue that everyone else in the world supports, and instead pay attention to only one weird, out-of-character non-statement, which implies he supports a totally taboo position, which is perhaps literally the most unpopular thing it is possible to think. And then you have to imagine some of the most brilliant rhetoricians and persuaders in the world are calculating that it's worth risking exposure to this taboo belief in order to win support from a tiny group with five-digit membership who support nobody wants by sending a secret message which inevitably every single media outlet in the world instantly picks up on and makes the focus of all their coverage for the rest of the election. Well, It couldn't have been said better than that, I think. And here's Mr. Woods commenting on same.
First of all, the very fact that these people have to be sort of uncovered, like you have to dig deep and say, well, they may say one thing, but they secretly believe another. Why do they need to secretly believe another if they're living in a white supremacist society? You know, the idea of a white supremacist or any racially supremacist society would be that the society would celebrate the supremacy. Or that that one manifestation of supremacy is that you wouldn't be fearful to talk about it.
Right.
Right. But there's nobody who's going to go out and say, I think, and but I don't know anybody who even secretly says, I think white people should be legally supreme over other races and should get special privileges that other races don't have. I genuinely and literally do not know anyone who holds that view. And in my opinion, that's the only view that could be described as white supremacy. But even if they did, their careers would be destroyed. They'd never be able to be in public office. They'd never be able to do really anything. No publisher would publish their book. No, I mean, they would be shunned from public life, which goes to show we do not even remotely live in a society like that.
Okay, that's all the time we have. This is Scott D. Cosenza for LibertyNation.com and the Uprising Podcast. Please visit LibertyNation.com. We've got the Rabbit Hole Podcast and some fine articles and video features for you to check out. Thanks to Tim Donner. Thanks to Coach Ditka. And that's it. Hope to see you next time. Bye-bye.